Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. This week, we're all familiar with border disputes on land, but what about those on the water? Maritime disputes in the Arctic and in the South China Sea are increasing as countries vie for valuable natural resources beneath the ocean's waves. Current international law sets strict guidelines on what economic rights countries have off their coast, but is the system in place the best one? Is the international law of the sea still sufficient today? Joining us on Global Journalist this week, John Bellinger, a partner at the law firm of Arnold & Porter in Washington, D.C. He's also an adjunct senior fellow in international law at the Council on Foreign Relations and served as the legal advisor to the Department of State under Condoleezza Rice from 2005 to 2009. Ted McDorman is a professor of law at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He specializes in international trade law, international ocean, and environmental law. And Frank Alcock is an associate professor of political science at New College of Florida, where he focuses on international law, sustainable development, and governance of the oceans. He's also the former director of the Moat Marine Laboratories Marine Policy Institute in Sarasota, Florida. And thanks to each and every one of you for joining us today on Global Journalist. Appreciate you being on board. So 165 countries and the European Union have joined the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, which came into force in 1974. But the United States has not. John Bellinger, tell us why.
Sure, and it's nice to be with you, and I'm here in Washington today. So the Law of the Sea Convention is a very comprehensive treaty, more than 300 articles that were negotiated in the 1970s and the 1980s. The United States were one of the leaders in negotiating these sets of rules, which are really sort of a constitution for the use of the world's oceans. When the treaty was finished, though, in the early 1980s, although the United States supported about 99% of what was in the treaty, there were certain provisions relating to mining on the deep seabed that the United States did not like. So we didn't sign the treaty originally. Those provisions were then fixed in the 1990s, and other industrial countries like Britain, Japan, Germany all joined, but the United States did not. And for the last decade or so, successive administrations, both Republican and Democratic, have tried to get our Senate to approve the treaty because it's supported by our military, supported by U.S. business, supported by environmental groups. But some senators have continued to have concerns about the treaty. I served, as you said, as the legal advisor, that's the general counsel for the State Department, during the second term of the Bush administration when Condoleezza Rice was the Secretary of State. And we tried very hard in the Bush administration to persuade the Senate to approve the treaty. The Obama administration has tried as well, but there continue to be concerns in the Senate about joining on to this treaty, even though, as you say, 165 countries are a party and only very few are not.
And Frank Alcock, the treaty, some folks call it unclosed. It has broad-reaching sorts of implications, everything from environmental business to, you know, fishing rights, that kind of thing. You've done some research on some of this, and what have you found in that?
Yeah, I'd just like to follow up on some of the points that John made. I uphold the Law of the Sea Treaty. It's a bit of an outlier with respect to international institutions in that substantively there's not much to complain about anymore. And it's rare that you see so many different interest groups in support of an agreement here in the United States, and yet there's still reluctance to ratify the treaty. I would add, if I had a point to a particular reason why the United States has not ratified the Law of the Sea Treaty, I think it's less substantive than it is symbolic. And I think you can, after some of those components with respect to mining in the deep seabed were fixed, and essentially I think the international community acquiesced to U.S. Desires to have a veto on the international seabed, and again have it a very, very mild in terms of its oversight authority, it's still a symbolic entity in the international domain, which is, I think, frightening to some of the conservative base.
Well,
if you look at the Tea Party movement over the last few years, and before the Tea Party emerged again, some of the stronger limited government sentiments in the conservative base, they just, the idea of having some sort of taxation go to an international entity or have some entity having authority over international domains is just scary. And I think even many on the Republican side that would like to do it, it's just they're inviting potential flack from the base. And so it's one of those things that they just let sit there and are reluctant to sign.
Well, and we'll talk with Professor McDormand shortly about particularly the Arctic, which there are some interesting maneuverings going on there. But Frank Alcock, to your point, the U.S. runs some very serious risk of falling significantly behind in some of the claims that they can make, because if they're not a signatory to the treaty, as I understand it, that means that they don't get some of the benefits, perhaps, of some of the jurisdictional sorts of claims that are now being staked, yes?
That's right, especially up in the Arctic region, and I guess we'll hear a little bit more about that. But under UNCLOS provisions, once you ratify a treaty, you have up to 10 years to claim continental shelf resources that are beyond your 200-mile exclusive economic zone. And as mining in the deep seabed up in the Arctic region becomes more viable, it becomes more attractive for, to U.S. commercial interests, they'll have no claims, or their claims will not be recognized unless we ratify the treaty. So I think that there is some sentiment there. And I think that's one of the things that is lost on some of the public, the idea that there would be some sort of entity that is not a U.S. entity that would be recognizing exclusive rights in international waters might be bothersome. But from a commercial perspective, the worst thing is there nobody has any rights that are recognized, and that that level of uncertainty is not in anybody's interest. So that's why you have an entity like the our Chamber of Commerce, U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They're in support of signature.
Among many others. Ted McDormand, let's talk a little bit about the Arctic situation, because certainly it appears that Russia has already begun to sort of make moves in terms of staking its claim on that region. Can you bring us up to date on some of the pressing issues in the Arctic right now?
Well, pressing issues are mostly to do with environmental and global climate change and those types of issues rather than so much the legal issues. Pressing issues also have to do with shipping, and there's work being done in the International Maritime Organization in London, to which the United States, I'm keenly aware, are playing a very proactive role in creating standards for vessels going into and out of polar waters. So those kinds of issues are sort of the most important issues. Now, the most public issues are issues around claims in the Arctic and to seafloor beyond 200 nautical miles, and the Russians have, consistent with the Law of the Sea Convention, indicated where their outer limit in the shelf is in the Arctic area. They and Norway actually have done that, and what we're waiting for is to see what Canada does and what Denmark does, and of course we are also waiting to see what the United States does. The United States has been very, not to speak for the U.S. with two very distinguished gentlemen there, but the United States have been doing an awful lot of work in the Arctic, and a lot of that work has been in cooperation with Canada, and a lot of that work has been in cooperation with Denmark. What I would get across in the Arctic for all of the discussions about the boundaries and stuff, there's an awful lot of cooperation that takes place amongst the countries in the Arctic.
You're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink. Today, we're looking at the challenges of international maritime disputes and whether the current legal framework is viable in the modern age. Joining us today, John Bellinger, a partner at the law firm of Arnold & Porter in Washington, D.C. He's also an adjunct senior fellow in international law at the Council on Foreign Relations and served as a legal advisor to the Department of State under Condoleezza Rice from 2005 to 2009. Ted McDormand is a professor of law at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He specializes in international trade law, international ocean and environment law. And Frank Alcock, an associate professor of political science at New College of Florida, where he focuses on international law, sustainable development, and governance of the oceans. He's also a former director of the Moat Marine Laboratories Marine Policy Institute in Sarasota, Florida. Would like to remind you, you can listen to this and other full episodes of Global Journalist on our website, that is globaljournalist.org. You can also find links to other stories related to this broadcast, including more on conflicts in the Arctic and in the South China Sea. For more on Global Journalist content, you can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Global Journ. So getting back to the topic and speaking of the South China Sea, John Bellinger, this is an issue that has certainly risen to international awareness. We have all sorts of different boundaries being drawn in the South China Sea. We have the Philippines, Vietnam, most notably China, Japan, Korea to some extent, staking claims. How does something like this get resolved? Does it get resolved?
So we've got numerous disputes, and this has been coming up more to a head in the last 5 years and really even the last year or two, disputes between Japan and China, between Japan and Korea, between China and some of the other countries, and there have been more and more incidents at sea, and the United States is growing quite worried about these. We've been generally neutral on the different disputes and have urged the parties in the different countries to settle the dispute peacefully. President Obama, as we do this show today, is actually in the region right now visiting Japan, Korea, Philippines, Malaysia, and has been urging these countries to settle these disputes. The Law of the Sea Convention itself does not provide a framework for resolution of territorial disputes. The Law of the Sea Convention provides a legal framework to resolve disputes involving the oceans or the resources in the oceans. The disputes in most of the disputes in the South China Sea and the East China Sea involve disputes over territory, over different islands, and the parties there will have to generally try to work those out between themselves. Right now, interestingly, the Philippines has brought a arbitration claim against China over some of the disputed territories, but China is refusing to participate in that arbitration, and it will be interesting to see whether the arbitrators who have been appointed will issue a decision, even though China has not participated. And I'll just end by saying this is one of the reasons that the Bush administration strongly supported Senate approval of the Law of the Sea Treaty was so that the United States would be in a treaty relationship with the rest of these countries in the region and be a part of the overall legal framework that governs the world's oceans. Our Navy in particular is very, very interested in having the United States become party to the Law of the Sea Treaty so that we can use the legal rights that are in the treaty to protect ourselves.
We have seen the this arbitration process work involving Chile and Peru in January, Russia and Norway in 2010, Somalia and Kenya also discussing some maritime boundaries. So those are countries that are all quite far afield. Ted McDormand, does the United States risk losing its voice by not being a signatory to this at some point when it comes to the dispute resolution that John Bellinger was just referencing?
I would say that the answer to that is that it's not the U.S. will never lose its voice. It's a powerful state. It's a state with, integrity. It's a state that is a major player. the difficulty tends to be that some countries and some people on occasion say, well, you're not a party to the treaty, so your voice may not be as strong as it might otherwise be. Mr. Bellinger is correct, however, very correct, on the South China Sea, that the Law of the Sea Convention doesn't have a lot to say about the island disputes in both the South China Sea and the East China Sea. And both the in those areas, the core issue, when you get down to it, is just the ownership over those islands. And that's not technically a law of the sea matter. The United States and the law of the sea, I would take some issue with some of the comments that have been made, but one of the key things for the United States is that it would provide the United States an opportunity to be a major player in the institutions of the law of the sea, and to regain sort of that leadership role that it has had in the past on law of the sea issues. And while it still has a leadership role being outside, it is much easier to be a leader when you're inside the camp rather than outside the camp.
Frank Alcock, as regards sort of some of the limitations and also sort of the boundaries, my understanding is that there's a 200-mile exclusive economic zone off of any particular coast, but the potential with the continental shelf to extend that several hundred miles more. There has to be, with the possibilities that exist under the ocean floor, lots of reasons to make that seem pretty attractive to a lot of places.
Yes, for countries that have broad continental shelves with the resources, both fisheries as well as mineral resources, it's an attractive option. Those extended claims under UNCLOS will not be recognized unless you're a signatory to UNCLOS, but you have up to 10 years after you ratify it. So if the United States did ratify the Law of the Sea Treaty, it would have up to 10 years to stake claims to extended continental shelf. A point I just want, it's worth swinging back to with respect to UNCLOS, is that you're not necessarily looking at a perfect or ideal legal arrangement that was meant to cover everything. It's very comprehensive, and there's a lot of good components to it, but the components are what you were able to politically agree to. Territorial disputes are probably some of the most contentious. Access to certain areas, even in the fisheries realm, again, are contentious. And I think what you'll find if you look within the Law of the Sea Treaty is recognition of the legitimacy of different types of principles that could be used to reconcile some competing claims. The coastlines of the world are not linear, and so you have a number of regions where you have overlapping claims. And I think two principles that are at odds with one another sometimes that are both recognized within the treaty as being legitimate, various history. Whether it be historical fishing grounds or a piece of territory or an island changing hands and who has ownership of that island. And I think that's probably the most relevant or salient issue in the South China Sea. But there's also the issue of zonal attachment.
Explain that.
Sort of having whether it be a fishing ground or an area of resources within 200 miles. I mean, if you had no historical claims, you might split the difference in terms of an area if there were resources in between, say, two island countries where the difference between them was 200 miles. So neither one of them gets the whole thing. You just split it in half.
Sure.
So the idea of some sort of fairness and equity with respect to zonal attachment is something that is recognized as legitimate, but you have that complicated, again, by a variety of historical claims. And then ultimately, again, you're not going to get an answer from UNCLOS. These things have to be worked out politically. And then back to the observation with respect to the Philippines wanting arbitration and China being reluctant to do that, I think that's pretty easy to understand politically. Usually you'll see weaker countries clamoring for some sort of arbitration process or some sort of legal resolution, whereas more powerful countries often don't mind a lack of resolution. They'll just, again,
as they wield their weight,
claims until it gets to a point where it just becomes so problematic that they might resort to some sort of legal resolution.
Jim, it's John Bellinger. Could I
get John
briefly to the Arctic?
Yeah.
Swing all the way from the South China Sea back to the Arctic?
It certainly is a lot of water, isn't it? Yeah, go ahead.
If I could just, and I don't want to step on Ted's turf because he's up there in Canada, but this is important for listeners, particularly in the middle of the country, to understand. The Law of the Sea Treaty guarantees a right for a country to the resources 200 miles off its coast, but in addition to an extended continental shelf, to its shelf underwater that goes beyond 200 miles, if it can show geologically that it is part of a country's continent. And for the United States, our extended continental shelf extends probably 600 miles off the coast of Alaska. So we have enormous oil and gas wealth. Some of the greatest oil and gas wealth in the world is off of Alaska, ready for us to claim it under the legal regime of the Law of the Sea Convention. The other Arctic coastal states, Canada, Russia, Norway, Denmark, have all filed claims to their extended continental shelves underwater so that they can get their resources. But we have not, because our Senate has not approved the treaty. Now, some conservatives will say, well, we ought to just claim that anyway. We can do what we want. Who needs to be part of a treaty? Well, the problem with that is that U.S. business is not going to go into a shaky legal regime and go engaging in oil and gas exploitation or collection of minerals on territory under the oceans that we can't claim a legal right to. So, you know, we in the Bush administration look very carefully at the rights that we would get under the treaty and concluded that this was an enormous economic win for us and that we were being left behind by not becoming a party to the treaty and that prevented us from claiming our resources up in the Arctic.
Ted McDormand, you know, there are vast areas of any given ocean that really sort of fall into more of a collective zone, do they not, where they're not within 200 miles, let alone the continental shelf extension. And my understanding of that is that that becomes part of a collective, if you will, that under the treaty, the signatories kind of work that out and can share that area. Is that correct?
I might have some different wording there. But, yeah, the idea is on the continental shelf, on the seafloor beyond 200 nautical miles or beyond the outer limit of a state shelf, that area is subject to the management, mineral resource management, by the International Seabed Authority, which is a UN body created by the Law of the Sea Convention. And that institution is supposed to work in a way that the resources can be exploited, but therefore to be for the sort of the common heritage of mankind idea and for the benefit both of the exploiter, of course, who has to get their profit, but also for the benefit of developing countries. And it was one of the great breakthroughs that was actually promoted at one time by the United States, that would be something that of a sharing of the resource, so to speak, the mineral resources only, beyond the area of national jurisdiction, and that is sort of the deep seafloor beds in the middle of the Pacific and the Atlantic. Mm. The question being, then we don't know the answer to this yet, is whether there would be any area in the Arctic Ocean that would actually be beyond the continental shelf of any of the states. And the presumption is that if there is an area that falls into this global commons, if you will, that it'll be a very, very tiny area.
What's interesting to me, John Bellinger, is, you know, and this is obviously a United Nations issue. We see the conflicts on land, and we see the different sensibilities, whether they be economic or cultural or social. And I think specifically about fishing, for instance, and the differences that, say, a Japan might have from a China or some of the other partners that might share sort of that part of the sea with them. Have we seen resolution to really deep divides yet, or is that something yet to be tested under all of this?
Well, we have had many countries around the world have worked out differences both with respect to territory and with respect to resources. So, for example, and I think it was alluded to, just in the last couple of years, Norway and Russia reached essentially a compromise on the boundary between their two oceans off of their two countries. They'd been disputing them for decades, and it's very important because there's oil and gas and fish in these areas. So there are two countries who worked something out. Back in the 1980s, the United States and Canada had had a long-standing dispute over the fishing resources off of Maine, in the Gulf of Maine. And after disagreeing for decades, the two countries submitted their dispute to the International Court of Justice in The Hague, and each side argued their points, and finally the International Court of Justice issued a decision that essentially split the baby and drew a line in the middle of the Gulf of Maine and said, Canada, you can have the resources on this side, and the United States, you can have the resources on the other side. Generally, countries have been able to work out these disputes. There's a tribunal that is set up specifically by the Law of the Sea Convention that sits in Hamburg, Germany, and that resolves disputes often involving ships that have been seized in a country's territorial waters. So countries do work out their disputes involving the resources in the ocean or territorial disputes.
Professor McDormand, where does this go from here in terms of it seems that with increasing frequency, we are beginning to see more and more disputes with that are going to this sort of a body to get resolved. What do you see happening in the near future, both with this body and also with, for instance, the United States' participation in it?
Well, the U.S. at the moment doesn't participate in the ITLOS, but the United States, of course, has a great record of it engaging in bilateral negotiations successfully with their neighbor states, including the Russia in the 1990 agreement in the Arctic. I think the point that has to be made is just because you have an overlapping claim between two or more states doesn't necessarily mean you have a hot dispute. Now, the South China Sea would be an exception to the contrary, where you have an area where there's overlapping claims because of the islands, and that's creating a fair bit of friction, I would say. But in the Arctic, I mean, Canada and the United States have overlapping claims there. In fact, Canada and the United States have overlapping claims everywhere, and that doesn't create a whole lot of friction between our two states. So you have to, it's a political science kind of game in a way where they see a dispute and assume there's a lot of friction. There's a lot of overlapping claims in the world, but there's not always a lot of friction that goes with that. Countries have an amazing capacity to be able to find ways to not resolve dispute necessarily, but to move forward and to prevent that friction from becoming really, really a difficult issue. We'll see more adjudications, I suspect, over time, but what we're really going to see is more negotiations, and negotiation settlements in the Arctic is inevitable. It may take us a while, but it's going to be inevitable, and there probably won't be nearly the type of friction in the Arctic overlapping claims as we're seeing in, at least in the South China.
That's all for this edition of Global Journalist, produced by the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Joining us on the program were John Bellinger, a partner at the law firm of Arnold & Porter in Washington, D.C., Ted McDormand, a professor of law at the University of Victoria in British Columbia, and Frank Alcock, an associate professor of political science at New College of Florida. Our executive producer is Casey Morrell. Our lead producer this week were Joanne Coca, with assistance from Alexander Drosler and Margot Henquinet. Travis McMillan from the Reynolds Journalism Institute is our technical director. Austin Federa from KBIA is our audio engineer. Join us again next time for another edition of Global Journalist. I'm Jim Flink.